Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming as a hobby, all things games. And this is another regularly scheduled weekly episode where we will pick one board game and we'll talk about it in depth. We'll talk about a little bit of the history behind it. We'll get into how it's played, what kind of strategies you can use when you play the game, and then we'll get into the design of the game. So, yeah. Matthew, what game are we talking about this week?
We are talking about the game Broom Service, designed by Andreas Pelikan and Alexander Pfister. It was published by Alea Games in 2015, and it also won the 2015 Kennerspiel des Jahres Award.
Very cool. Kennerspiel is a pretty prestigious award for games that are a little more,
on the hobbyist?
Yeah, a little more on the hobbyist side. They're less beginner-friendly. But I think this game is relatively beginner friendly.
Oh, yeah.
So to give a little bit about what Broom Service's gameplay is all about, in Broom Service, players are a fleet of wizards, druids, and gnomes and fairies who aim to deliver potions and clear away pesky storm clouds in a fantasy landscape. Each turn, players select four personas and take turns in trick-taking rounds, playing the personas to perform their actions. The player going first in the trick-taking round chooses a persona, and then every other player follows suit, playing the same persona in order if they also selected it from their hand of four cards, or for their hand of four cards. Whenever a player plays a card, they may choose to either perform the brave action or the cowardly action on that card. The cowardly action will happen immediately when a player plays the card, but only the last player to choose to pick the brave action gets to take that action. So if one player picks a brave action and then later on another player will pick the brave action for the same card in that round, then only the last player to do so gets to perform the action. So the different personas in the game, witches will move and sometimes deliver potions to the towers on the map. Druids will deliver potions to the towers without moving, and sometimes they will gain bonus points. Fairies will dispel the clouds that cover the map and also sometimes gain bonus points. And gnomes, which are called gatherers in this game, will gather 1 to 3 resources. So there are 7 turns of trick-taking. Each turn ends when each player has played all 4 of the personas that they have selected for their hand. And then after 7 turns, the game ends and points are totaled and whoever has the most points wins. So that is the basics of how Broom Service is played.
Yes.
And now it should also be mentioned that so at the beginning of the game, it's selected one person to start the whole thing. But after the first round of trick-taking, after one persona has been played, the last player to have played a brave action gets to select the next persona to be played. So that means, for example, if Matthew and I were playing, and I chose to play a brave mountain witch, and then Matthew played the brave mountain witch as well, therefore being the last player to play a brave action, he gets to take that action, and then he gets to choose what persona he plays next. And then if I have it, I have to play it. And play continues like that. So let's talk about strategy.
All right.
So where should we start with strategy?
So I think I want to start with just a basic overview of the resources and terrain. So there are 3 colors of potions.
Mm-hmm. There's green, violet, and orange.
There is wands, which are used to clear clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are 4 types of terrain. There's forests, plains, hills, and mountains.
Right. And so these terrains are important because there are 4 kinds of witches, 1 for each terrain. And whenever you play that witch, you will move 1 of your 2 pawns to that terrain of that type. The 2 pawns you have, by the way, start near the bottom left corner of the board. And you will want to move them throughout the game towards the upper right corner, because the towers that you can deliver potions to near the bottom left corner will award you with less points than the towers in the top right corner.
Right. And towards the top right, or towards the bottom left, there are more towers that can repeatedly accept potions.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the top right, the ones with better rewards are more likely to be single use. Only one person can deliver a potion right at once.
There are two types of towers. The round towers, you can only deliver potions to once. Afterwards, they become unavailable for the rest of the game. The square towers, you can deliver to any number of times per game. Now, there's also druids who care about the terrain type. There's two kinds of druids, that, and each one cares about two terrain types. And what they do is they just check to see if your pawn is on the right kind of terrain. And if they are, then you can deliver a potion to a tower on or on the in that terrain or on the border of that terrain.
Right.
So let's talk about brave actions, because the whole game revolves around trying to either do brave actions or just performing the cowardly actions to make reliable turns.
Right. And this is a somewhat complicated decision tree,
mm-hmm.
though I do have like a standard set of questions you should ask yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because so obviously when you take the brave action and you get it successfully, you're going to be first next round. However, that means that if you wanted to take the brave action next round, you would most likely get it stolen from you.
Yeah, pretty much it's guaranteed that if you the first card played is the brave action, it probably won't go to that player. Right. It's very rare that a player has a card that nobody else has. Although sometimes it happens, at least in the opening hand, like for the first or second card, maybe you might be able to figure something out on like a later card in the hand when it comes down to like everybody just has one card in their hand. But right. It's unlikely.
Right. So there are four questions that I have written down. The first is, do I want this card, or no, do I need this card to do something? Because if you take the brave action and somebody else takes it from you, you don't get anything for that card.
Yeah, you do
and
nothing.
This is especially important for the gatherers, which give you resources in. Even if you take the cowardly action for the gatherer, you're still getting a resource that you can then use on points.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always a good question to ask. There is also, do I need the next card in my hand to have a brave action? So when you think about how if you have a brave action, you go first. And if you are last, then you're guaranteed to get the brave action if it comes to you.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's usually a bad idea to take brave actions until you get a chance to take the brave action for the card you need it.
Right.
And
so and we should say that probably the one you're going to need the most is the witch.
Yeah.
As a brave action.
Are the best.
Yes, because the witch, the cowardly action for the witch is just to move to the terrain of that type. The brave action is to move and then immediately deliver a potion to a tower in or bordering the territory that you just moved to.
Right.
So you can see how that would be very good.
It's quicker point returns, and it can get you, you know, the lead in terms of securing those one-time use towers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some of the really important ones. Another question to ask yourself in this case is, do I think somebody else really needs this resource? This is more for gatherers, but other people, you know, like this could apply to witches as well. So this is where you want to look at other players' sort of inventory, their resources they have. And if you think somebody else needs a brave action or something like that, you can play a card if you're first and name cowardly, which basically forces them to take that sort of window.
So,
and what I mean specifically is that you often try to use this to force other players to take the brave action so you go later in the next trick.
Mm-hmm. So we're kind of talking about how to, like, set up yourself for a safer brave action.
Right, yeah.
So this is kind of a facet of the strategy of this game, where the main strategy is obviously you want to earn points by having the most efficient turns, and you know, getting the most points. And you do that by performing the optimal brave actions, and you do that by going through this process of setting yourself up for very, like, assured brave actions.
And even if you can't set yourself up for an assured brave action, if you can try to wait to play the brave action you need until other players have, like, two cards in hand, then it becomes a lot easier to figure out what those last two cards are. Mm-hmm. And then you can much more easier make these calculations to guess them and predict them.
As a turn goes on, it becomes significantly easier to predict what cards your opponents are holding in their hands. Especially one big tell is because you have to play the cards if somebody else plays that card. If the trick starts with one particular type of card, you have to play it, so you can't choose your order. Sometimes you'll see a player play a card because they have to, and then not do anything, which is an option for any card. And that is usually a big tell for what other cards are in their hand. Like, for example, they might play the witch and then not move their pawns, and that's probably because they want to play a druid for a territory that their pawns are already in. They don't want to abandon that territory yet because they have points they've yet to make. So this brings something up, because we're talking about sequencing your cards so that you can assuredly play brave cards, or you can at least get a good read on the table so you know when you can play your brave cards. But sequencing your cards is not in your control for a large portion of this game. So one important thing to keep in mind is that you want to select cards that can be played in any order.
Yeah, because
it happened multiple times in our play sessions where people would pick a hand of cards that was really only meant to be played in one order. And if it were played in any other order, then the hand was useless. Like, it was for example, I had a turn where I needed to, in this order, I needed to move to a territory, score a tower in that territory, which could have taken one or two cards, and I had both just in case. I needed to move to a territory, score a tower in the territory by delivering a potion, clear a cloud in a nearby territory, and then move into that territory. So that was a specific 3 to 4 card sequence, and it was totally ruined. You could never rely on that kind of thing happening in this game. You should always plan turns that can happen in nearly any order. Or maybe another way of saying that is you can do that, but make sure your cards can be rearranged in some forms of configurations.
Yeah, have a fallback plan.
Yeah, exactly. Have that fallback, because if things go wrong and you have to, like, miss an entire round, an entire turn of playing cards, then that sets you way far back. Like, you're back. I mean, messing up one turn in this game can mean messing up 4 turns.
Right. And even then, like, if you think about, so delivering a potion is worth maybe an average of 4 points, then if you mess up a turn, you're missing out on at least 4 or 8 points.
Mm-hmm.
That then means you're 4 points behind everybody else. Which means that if that's, like, the bottom amount or the average amount for a single turn, that means you've wasted the turn and you can't get it back.
Mm-hmm. And there's honestly a very low number of turns in this game. It ends pretty quickly, so you don't get a lot of time to make up for a deficit for a messed up turn. So pretty much every single turn you plan out, every selection of 4 cards, make sure they can work in any order. And I will add to that, make sure you have at least 1 throwaway card. And this is something that, Matthew, I don't know if you were doing this intentionally, but I saw you do this on a number of turns when we played. And that was, you would play, you would be the first player because you played the last Brave card, and you would play a card Brave, like, on purpose. Usually, yeah, when you see people going first, they almost always play the cards cowardly because they want to do something. But it seemed like you always had at least one card in your four that you were willing to not perform the actions of, that you were willing to play Brave so that other people would play Brave and take away first player just so that you were no longer first player.
Exactly, yeah. Because if turn order can be that important, I would rather pick a card that guarantees or heavily guarantees that I'll get the order that I want, rather than a card that gets a slightly, you know, it gets one resource or a tiny amount of points over that.
Right. You might say that, like, performing a brave, a good brave action, like performing the brave action of your choice, is worth more than one card. Yeah. I mean, it's worth more than two cards. Even because you have to spend the one card to get the brave off of you, and then you spend the other card when you perform the actual brave action. And in this game, brave actions are worth about three cards. For example, right. The witch lets you move and then deliver immediately, so that's two cards technically. But moving is so important in this game that I you'd value movement over a lot of other actions. So I might just count that as like 2.5 or 3, just because moving is so important. Action wise, action economy wise. Druids lets you deliver and get extra points. And like you said, a potion delivery is worth about 4 points on average, and a druid gives you 3 bonus points. So you can almost picture playing a brave druid as delivering one potion and then delivering 3/4 of an extra potion for free.
Yeah, like, and that's meaning maybe like 3 cards.
Yeah, that's 3 cards because it's a card to deliver the first potion, and then it's technically a card to collect another potion, and then another card to deliver that other potion. So yeah, that's 3 cards and, essentially.
And the gatherers are the most direct one, where cowardly gatherers give you 1 resource and brave gatherers give you 3.
Mm-hmm. And then much like the druid, the fairy gives you 3 bonus points, so you can use the same reasoning there. So what we're saying is, essentially, your throwaway card is immediately made up for if you can get the right brave card.
Exactly.
Because that brave card's going to be worth 3 points, 3 cards. It was worth it to ditch a card.
I will say that gatherers, there is a lot of times where you can just sneak in a brave gatherer, because over the course of the game, I mean, if you're getting, you know, 1 color of potion and then spending a couple other colors, you'll end up with a deficit in at least 1 color of potion. And, I mean, obviously, other players aren't going to want to constantly gather resources and potions, meaning it's easy to find time where you're the only one with a deficit in a certain potion. Nobody else seems to be taking it. You're almost guaranteed to play it for brave and then get 3 resources that, you know, it saves 3 turns almost.
Mm-hmm. So there's one thing we haven't touched a lot on, and that is the clouds, which are a secondary way of gaining lots of points. The way that the clouds work is that you spend the wands to get rid of them. You have to use the fairy persona to get rid of them. And getting rid of them will put the cloud in your inventory. And each cloud has a number of lightning bolts on them. And at the end of the game, depending on how many lightning bolts you've acquired throughout the game, you gain a large sum of points.
Right, it's not a linear correlation.
Right, because so the way it works out is the first 2 lightning bolts you collect are worth 3 points each. The second 2 lightning bolts you collect are worth 4 points each, and so on and so forth up to 7 lightning bolts, I think, is the max. So it's 19, 24. And we said earlier that potions are worth, in general, about 4 points each, but the availability of towers can dry up pretty quickly, And some of the towers you deliver to can give you wands, which you spend the wands to unlock the clouds. So there's sort of like an opportunity to get points from the clouds, and sometimes that will outweigh the time and effort that it goes into delivering potions, like the amount of points you'll get from that. Now there's
typically, typically get it, like actually getting the wands is incidental to the rest of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, if you can get like four wands, you can easily get two lightning bolts, which is 6 points. So you can play a fairy, get a cloud. I mean, it's a little less than the potions might be, but considering that like you don't really need to do much else to get the wands, it's easy points.
Mm-hmm. Also, yeah, it's kind of like it's in a lot of games you'll see these like alternate revenue streams, how I'll refer to them. You'll see them appear, and I think they've come up in a lot of the games we've covered recently, how they'll look appealing as like an alternate strategy, but for the most part they almost never work out because they just take too much of your time and attention away from the main strategies that give you more points in the end. But in this case, the wands can they don't serve as a replacement for delivering potions. You're going to have to do both, but as an extra revenue stream, they can sometimes make the difference between losing and winning.
Right. I think fairies are the best throwaway card for being brave.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if you get the brave effect, that's 6 points, which is above average
mm-hmm.
for a card. Yeah.
And if if you don't get to spend your wands, then it's not like you're doing nothing. It's like you're just saving your wands for the next one.
Right. It's also true that there are clouds that are on spaces with higher scoring towers towards the right of the board. And sometimes, I mean, like you might want to clear those up anyway so you can go in and score. And so if you don't get the cloud action early on in the game, that's always an opportunity later.
Mm-hmm. Also, sometimes it might be better to let someone else clear those clouds so that you can move in first and take the towers away first.
Exactly.
I will say one more thing about it strategy wise, and this is more like to relieve like a mental burden of having to keep track of points. Just you can kind of know with the lightning bolts that if you're keeping up with the pack of players just throughout the game, there is a point tracker that goes around the board. So as long as your pawn or your tracker is near the other players, then you'll know that whoever has the most lightning bolts is probably going to win from those extra points generated at the end of the game. So collecting some lightning bolts early and then spending the rest of your time keeping up with your opponents is one way of winning the game. And it's one way of kind of compartmentalizing the strategies in the game and what you have to pay attention to. Right. You get what I'm saying? It's kind of like you set it and forget it. And then as long as you're keeping up, you're actually winning.
Yeah.
And I think multiple times, it's been almost a surprise to see somebody like launch into first or second place from their lightning bolts at the end of the game. Like they can kind of be deceptive.
Yeah.
I don't know if you mentioned it, but there is a chance for one of the clouds to be worth 3 lightning bolts. It costs each cloud costs a number of wands to collect off the board. The minimum being 1, the maximum being this one cloud that costs 6 wands, and it gives you 3 lightning bolts. I'd say shoot for that if you can.
Yeah, because that's 10 points.
Yeah, that's a great sum of points for just one turn. And like you said, the lightning bolt collection is incidental. You can just kind of target those towers that give you wands for scoring them to make things a little easier on you. And then one of the gatherers will give you 2 wands if you get the brave action off. So all that combined, it's not hard to get up to 6 wands. And just pulling that off is a huge benefit to your points for winning.
Yeah.
So if you can, try and get that. But it doesn't show up in every game. So, you know, just when you can.
Right.
Let's see. Is there anything else we need to talk about? Oh, you mentioned looking at your opponent's resources to try and read about what they're doing, but you can also look at where their pawns are on the board.
Oh, yeah.
You know, most obviously, if an opponent's pawns aren't on a terrain that one of the two druids would count for, then you can almost guarantee that they don't have the druid. There's sometimes when they'll have a witch and a druid that they intend to move and then score with the druid.
I've done that before.
So it's been, so sometimes you can get surprised where you'll play like a hilltop druid or whatever it's called. A peak druid is what it's called, which cares about mountains and hills. And you see your opponents don't have any pawns on mountains and hills. So you think you're safe. And then they happen to have one because they intended to move there later. So, but anyways, yeah, you can look at your position. You could also see like, is the forest terrains around my opponent's pieces, do they have good towers in them? Is if the towers are already scored in those terrains, or the towers in those terrains are lower point value than the ones in other terrains, then you might be able to guess, like, oh, my opponents aren't probably trying to go to a forest right now, so I'm probably safe to play a brave forest wizard.
Right. Yeah. All right. So we want to get into the design?
Yes, because there is a lot to get into about the design.
Yes.
One thing that I want to point out before we get into all of the complexities that revolve around the trick-taking system in this game, one thing I want to point out that's really cool, and this is something I always like to point out, is when a game inadvertently teaches you something that you need to keep a lookout strategy-wise for, what this game does, it's kind of overtly, is when you're giving out resources at the beginning of the game, in a lot of games, the player going first will have slightly less resources than the other players. Sometimes it gradually increases. Sometimes they just have a deficit and then everybody else has a little bit more, but they have the same amount. In this game, the deficit goes to both the player going first and the player going last. So right away from that, you can pick out that there's an importance to going last as well as going first.
Exactly.
Which is very cool.
Before we dig into things too much, I also want to say that I like that there are only five unique regions on the map. There's the four where you can get points, and then the oceans where a lot of clouds are.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually like a mathematical thing that any map can be like colored in with at least five colors, meaning any map could be colored in with five different colors, or in this case terrain types. And this is used so that no terrain is adjacent to the same terrain.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
so let's talk about what the trick taking mechanic does as far as game design goes.
Yeah,
because it does. There's a lot of layers to it, a lot of levels to the things that it adds to the game. So one point that I want to start talking about is that the whole thing, you have 10 cards of the same kind that everyone is picking from the same 10 cards. Everyone has their own set, but everyone has the same 10 cards, so you know what your opponents have, and your resources and where your pawns are is all open information. So reading is obviously an important part of this game, but the way that the trick taking works and how you whittle down cards from your hand as the thing goes, you almost don't have to read what your opponents do until like halfway through the trick taking process. Right. So it's good for beginner players because they don't have to really think that hard about what four cards they pick. That's a big decision. But it seems like in this game, it's pretty easy because the benefit to reading what your opponents can do doesn't come until later in the round, until long after you've already picked your four cards.
So a lot of these social deduction games and even just trick-taking games in general can lead to really easy analysis paralysis,
mm-hmm.
where like you can't figure out what the optimal move is. Another way this game does it is by making a very clear sequence of events that need to be done, or like a very clear role for each card. So each card or each persona or whatever does a very easy to understand thing. Gatherers get resources, witches move, druids deliver. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of compartmentalize when you're thinking about the game. Instead of thinking it on a card by card basis, you think it on a group by group basis. Mm-hmm. So like, I want to play a gatherer, I want to play a witch, and so forth.
Yeah, and so that
even
makes
beyond
the decision beyond making that, very easy. It also makes the reading very easy.
Right, and even beyond that, you'll often automatically skip over a couple cards in your 10-card set of cards, because either you'll be on a place that you don't want to move into because you're already on it, or you don't have a color of potion, so you automatically need one, or you do have a lot of a color of a potion, so you don't need to worry about that gather at all. So it never feels like you're choosing from a hand of 10 cards,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, again, helps cut down the number of decisions without actually cutting down the number of decisions.
Right. So the very obvious progression of actions that you have to take in the game, made obvious by the simplicity of the roles and the ease of understanding how they fit into one another, all goes into making this very difficult decision in any other game a very simple one that anyone right. can make very quickly. Like, I mean, we play drafting games. I played Seven Wonders recently, which we did an episode on. And it, like, even the when the hands in Seven Wonders were, I mean, they already start with less cards than you start with in any round of this game. But it seemed like even when it was down to four cards, the decision in Seven Wonders was significantly more difficult than just picking your four from the 10 in this game.
Right.
It happens very quickly.
Right. And this also helps with pacing of the game,
mm-hmm.
because it eliminates a lot of the waiting time and decision-making time between tricks and just goes straight into the trick-taking part.
Right. And it is a trick-taking game. The most fun is going to be had during the actual trick-taking and not the setup right. for it.
Right. And, I mean, it definitely accomplishes that. I think a big part of why this game does the trick-taking part so well and why I think it includes it is that when you sort of ignore that and set it aside, this is sort of an area control game where you want to plan ahead and make sure you have resources and beat others to the punch.
Mm-hmm.
The thing trick-taking does is it forces every player to stay actively involved with the game. It's very hard to forget what you're going to do in the game, I feel, because every round, every time somebody plays a card and then it comes to you, you are thinking again about at least a choice, whether to brave or to coward mm-hmm. or cower. And being, I mean, even though it's a, you know, one or the other choice, oftentimes it's still enough of a choice that it makes you keep cycling through the information you have and the calculations you're making.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it keeps your mind active.
I kind of want to compare this to a worker placement game, which worker placement is a mechanic that's kind of similar to this, to a trick-taking mechanic, in that it's a mechanic that cares about turn order. Although this game, the trick-taking mechanic, what it does for it is it makes the change of turn order happen way more often, and it places an even heavier importance on turn order. In worker placement, it's just you're trying to be first come first serve, and the who gets to go first is changed like after every round of worker placement, which takes a long time compared to this game, because right. this game it can change on a dime who goes first. It changes in the middle of a turn who goes first. I think another interesting part, if you compare this to worker placement, is as a worker placement turn progresses, your options are taken away from you. In this game, it's the opposite. As the turn progresses, your options have been whittled down for you, down to this choice between coward or hero.
Exactly. In a way, it sometimes becomes clearer what your options are or what your action should be, but but it becomes more clear as to like every other part of the game state and the board state.
Mm-hmm. And I think as a whole, this makes it a more active gaming experience. You know, you're paying attention. You have to pay attention more, and you get chances to focus on other things in this game. Right. Your mind space is cleared up for other decisions in this game.
Right. If a lot of strategy games or worker placement games are like sprints where you do a lot of the calculating on your turn, but then there's a brief waiting period. This is a jog where you're constantly, you know, told to refresh your mind and you're constantly bringing things back to the forefront. And also, so there's an idea in game design of intentionality, which is like getting the player to the point where every action they do with a purpose and they are sure of that purpose. And it's sort of in a way getting the player to the mindset the game wants the player to have.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these design decisions help bring players quickly to that point by, you know, showing the clear effects of each card, showing the cause and effect and the, you know, turn order and how that works. All of this is to help bring this idea of reading your opponents and picking carefully. You know, it brings it to the forefront because it has this idea and it wants to make sure the player knows that that's what it's about.
Now, we mentioned turn order. I think one interesting thing that I just realized was that every card has three actions you can do with it.
Right. Or even four.
Even four. Yeah. Because it has, you could do the brave action, you could do the cowardly action. And then every card also has the ability to change the turn order. That's kind of cool. Yeah.
And so this is another fun word that I believe Mark Rosewater coined, maybe not, but it's lenticular design. Mm-hmm. When an object or a game piece in the game or a mechanic or whatever is very simply described, but it has wide and diverse applications just because of the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it's
more hidden than maybe an example that Magic would give you for a card with lenticular design.
Not necessarily. Because, I mean, the cards that Mark Rosewater talks about that are lenticular in their design are cards with hidden modes that encourage players to really, really consider what all the things the card can do. So in this game, it's the Brave action. You know, we talked about how it can be used to force other players to take a brave action or to try to bait others into doing so you could go last, or you could go first so you could play a card and force others to play it out of sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is all just one word, brave. Mm-hmm. But and it's not like these are additional rules. It's all just consequences of the rule.
I think, speaking of brave and cowardly actions, I think it's very cool in this game how neither is strictly worse or better than the other. Like, in every case, cowardly or brave, which one is better is different. And it's funny because it seems like, brave should be better every time. But obviously, right, there's times where brave will pretty much always get taken from you. There's times where you don't want to be first for the next round, so you want to take cowardly.
There's times where you really have to hedge your bets on whether someone will be brave or not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but you sometimes just have to risk it.
But also, like we said, brave actions are worth three cards, or three turns. So you need to take some brave action. You need to take many brave actions. The player who takes the most brave actions has the best chance of winning.
Yeah.
That said, there's so many different things to weigh against one another that both actions, neither one is strictly better or worse. It's kind of like there's games that will put in cards and player actions that are actually strictly worse, kind of like newbie traps in a game.
Yeah.
and there's a whole bunch of discussion on whether they're needed in games. You know, maybe it's just a way to force people to make very important decisions and kind of like show some kind of mastery of a game. But it's kind of cool that in this game, that doesn't necessarily exist. Like, the only existence of that is when you actually do something that does nothing. And maybe the only existence of that is when you pick a hand of four cards that is unplayable if the order gets messed up. But like that's all like metagame stuff. The actual design of the game has no bad decisions in
it. Right. It's very airtight, very eloquent, elegant, mm-hmm. both
elegant.
Of those.
Yeah. Yeah, eloquent. Definitely eloquent, because how they say brave and cowardly is hilarious.
Yeah, it's perfect because as I was playing the game for the first time, even I was like, I mean, I would have to be brave in order to brave sometimes. Likewise, sometimes it feels cowardly to take the cowardly action.
I mean, especially like if you're the second person to go.
Yeah.
Sometimes like the person who went first, it doesn't matter if they pick brave or cowardly, you're the second person. You know, there's two more people after you that have the chance to play the card. But, you know, there's an even better chance that a brave might actually work going second in like, say, a four person game. So it does still feel it definitely feels cowardly then when you're like, well, I can't really get a read on whether the other two players have it. There is a chance, but I'm still going to pick cowardly. And then it passes. They didn't pick the card, it turns out.
Right.
Yeah, that feels cowardly. Yeah, I love. Plus, and in the rule book, it tells you that you technically have to, in the rules, say, I am a brave mountain witch, or I am a cowardly peak druid. You have to speak in the first person when you play the cards. You have to say that you're brave. Adds a really fun moment when like it's coming to the part where everyone's jockeying for the brave position, because then it's people like shouting over one another, I'm the brave one. No, I'm the brave one. No, I'm the brave one.
I am the brave Spartacus.
Yes, exactly. But
in a way, it also kind of plays mind games with you. Like, I know for a fact there was one time where I took a cowardly action and I felt taunted by the game.
Yeah.
But I'm fine with that. It's almost comical.
You want to be, yeah, you want to be brave. Be brave for mother.
Yeah.
But sometimes you have to be cowardly. Oftentimes you just have to be cowardly.
Yeah.
So is there anything else mechanics wise you want to talk about this game?
Let me do a quick scan over my notes.
Mm-hmm. I do want to touch real quick back on the first and last dynamic, and mention that, being first. So obviously being first is unfortunate. And we talked a lot about ways of ditching the first player, because that means you can't play a brave action. Although there is benefits to going first in that you get to decide the order of actions. So if there is a cowardly action, for example, you need to play a cowardly witch so that you're on a specific terrain to either score a druid or score a fairy for a cloud that wouldn't have been adjacent to the previous terrain. Then there is a benefit to going first, because you're guaranteed to play that witch before you have to play the other cards. And then there's a slight benefit, which is harder to control and harder to utilize, but going first means that you can disrupt the order of other players' turns. It would take a lot of reading to actually pull something like that off, but it is a possibility in the game.
Yeah. It's also that if you want to like move and then deliver with a witch, then a druid, or a witch, then a fairy, then like, I mean, the witch then becomes fine to play cowardly either way. Mm-hmm. I do think it's cool that like even the witch, which we've said has like the best brave option, there's still plenty of chances where it's fine and almost preferable to take cowardly.
Mm. Oh, there's one more thing that we haven't mentioned yet that is a part of the game, and that's events.
Oh, yeah.
It's taken us till now to mention them, 44 minutes in, but we said that the game has 7 turns. There are 7 events that signify the beginning of a turn or the end of a turn that occur every turn. One event occurs every turn. There's 7 events. When the events run out, that's how the game ends. And there's 10 possible events that come with the game, and each one of them can modify a turn to varying degrees. Like, for the example of events that don't modify a turn very much at all, There are events that will change the cowardly option of every card, or that will give you an extra option for the cowardly action of every card. Like, if you take a cowardly action, you can choose to instead gain 3 points. Or if you take a cowardly action, you can choose to instead gain 1 resource of any kind, which is nice. I suppose these cards let you take riskier turns because your cowardly option can still be useful to some extent.
Right.
But then they can really change how a turn is played.
Oh, yeah. And I think, in general, the thing about these events is that they almost never take priority over the regular game flow.
Mm-hmm.
But it's to the point where it gives you something to consider. So, like, there are events that will make it so if you end the turn with pawns on a certain type of terrain, you'll lose points.
Mm-hmm.
But it never makes you lose more than 3 points from a single terrain. So, like, I think in this case, the events don't detract from the rest of the game. You know, it doesn't interrupt the main part of the game, and it doesn't turn it into just, like, a mini-game challenge.
Yeah, yeah, the events aren't so important that it's the only thing you're really looking at every turn.
Right.
They're just something to keep in mind. Sometimes, when in the example you gave where some terrains will make you lose points, those are sometimes nice because they actually simplify the reading of your opponents, because you can more often guess that they're probably going to play some witches that will move them onto terrains that won't make them lose too many points. So they kind of help the game in that way. They make it a little easier to read in that regard.
Right.
Although and there's I want to mention one event real quick, unless you want to move on to your point. I was just going to mention a couple of the events that can really shake up how the turn plays.
Oh, yeah.
For example, there's one event that the event lets you choose, instead of having to choose 4 cards, you could choose anywhere from 1 to 5 cards. And depending on how many cards you choose to, or personas you choose to go with for that round, you will gain or lose points.
Right. And I think with these sorts of mechanics where you have like a new event every turn or something, it's easy for that to sort of sweep up the game and sort of control it. Not really railroading, but like people tend to focus more on the event if it has a huge impact.
Mm-hmm.
But then the game becomes about the events and not the rest of the game. I think this does it fine, though, with like an event can be, you know, half a potion or... So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think kind of what you're saying is like the events, they're cool, but they don't mess you up and they don't distract you.
They don't interrupt the game.
They don't interrupt the game. Although, like the event that lets you draw more cards or that lets you play more or less cards.
Right. That's the biggest one.
It's the biggest one. And there's the way that the events work out. I think there's really only a chance that you'll get one of those in any given game. So like you'll get that one, or maybe there's one other card that I can't think of it right now, but I think there's one other event that might more or less take up your attention during a turn. Those kind of things will only happen like once or twice a game. So it's kind of like a special event, like you're playing the game for a little bit and then you get this little surprise somewhere in the middle that's pleasant that maybe shakes things up for a little bit, but then you're back to the game, which I kind of like. Yeah. It's like a little happy surprise. It's like a mini game in Mario Party. But like just one of them just in the middle of the game and then back to usual.
Yeah. Or halftime.
Yeah.
The one design point I wanted to make still was that by having cards that are by having there being a high chance that a given card is useless during a turn, like a gatherer when you have enough of that resource, it makes it much more likely that all players will pick the same card, or like, you know, every player but one will pick the same card in their hand, which, I mean, it just makes it more likely for the fun part of the game to happen. And when you're designing a game, you want to maximize the fun part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
This has like just enough cards where that, you know, if you take out the 2 or 3 or 4 even that you don't care about, then you're down to a pretty small amount that you can then, you know, figure every player then might want to pick the same 2 cards. Which, yeah, again, the fun of the game comes when players pick the same cards.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the game sort of leads to.
You know what I just realized now is because you have to give up the resource from your personal supply and then sometimes prevent anyone else from scoring on the same tower that you just delivered to, or collecting the same cloud you just collected because now it's in your collection. Pretty quickly, like as soon as one tower is delivered to, it changes everyone's strategy in the game.
Oh,
so
yeah.
In this game where everyone has the opportunities to pick the same actions, very quickly, everyone is picking actions for different reasons. And so everyone is prioritizing different actions over one another. Like, just like I said, like if you get to deliver a green potion to the tower, to the green tower, now other people are less incentivized to go to that green tower, and you are more incentivized, or other people are more incentivized to go to other green towers because they still have their green resources and they want to spend them. Meanwhile, you are more incentivized to collect a green resource before you start moving anywhere with a green tower. So it immediately separates you from the rest of the group. And then this happens multiple times in just the first turn, kind of fractures the group into these different strategies where you move on the board. You might move one direction. Somebody might move another direction, you know. So the way the game is designed, the way that you spend the resources permanently and you block off ways of scoring points permanently, and the way you can go across the board in different directions, it all serves to make it so that people are not making the same four decisions every turn in a row from the same pool of 10 cards, which is very nice.
Yeah.
Very well designed.
All right.
I want to talk about the artwork and design real quick.
Okay.
It's good quality artwork. It looks like a children's book, but like a good children's book, you know, like from the 90s when like they used gold leaf on the covers for just like normal like children's books. It's good.
I like the characters' names.
Oh yeah, they have silly names. The versions we have also came in both English and French, and they had like a full set of cards for both languages, and it was kind of interesting that the French names were different than the English names, but it makes sense because they're all kind of puns, so it's obvious that the French puns would be different than the English puns. Either way, it's interesting. The everything is pretty well laid out and visible and clear. You did mention how you like the point tracker.
Oh yeah,
in this game.
This is one of the rare games where I'm okay with the point tracker wrapping around the board.
Yeah, normally it's kind of it kind of gets in the way visually, or it's
right.
a little
this,
destructive or out of place.
Right, they intentionally like dim the colors at the edges of the terrains on the edge of the board, so that when you have the point tracker there, it just kind of flows over it naturally. Mm-hmm. Also, that they use sort of indented or jutting out squares for the like the five multiples.
Yeah, the kind
10
of
multiples.
Milestones, 5 and 10.
Yeah.
There's also there's no border. Like you said, the colors kind of fade when it gets near the border, the point tracker, but there's no like extra wall in between the two, which I think is good.
Yeah.
It leaves more room for artwork. You know they didn't need it.
It makes it feel less jutting out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, less shocking or whatever.
Ooh, and I will say that a pet peeve of mine is games that have point trackers, but you don't move on them until like the end of the game.
Oh yeah,
really? And this game does well. There's a lot of games that do it well where you're constantly moving around the board. This game does it well. Kudos to them for making a game with a point tracker and then actually using it during the game. You know, far too often it's like, did we really need a tracker for this, or could we have just counted at the end of the game?
Yeah.
All right. So that is Broom Service. So what are some similar games to Broom Service, Matthew?
My first thing that comes to mind is Citadels, which is a very similar social deduction role-taking game. Not as much of a trick-taking aspect, but it is one where turn order is important and determined by cards. And it does have like a resource gathering and spending portion, though it is with one resource.
Right. It makes the selection of the roles a little more intense. You only select one. and the risks are much higher. Like in this game, you have the chance of losing one of your four turns by picking a brave one and having it stolen from you. In that game, you lose an entire turn, which is you don't get three chances of redemption in the same turn. Like you just lose the whole turn.
Right.
But yeah, that is a very good role selection deduction game.
I just thought if you don't want the resource management area control aspect, Love Letter is another very good social deduction light card game.
Mm-hmm.
This one's only cards, but it has a very similar weight given to each card play.
Mm-hmm. That's a kind of a good sentiment because because sometimes usually in this section we talk about more complex games or maybe lateral games. But that is a lateral game, but it's a less complex game. So if you want to get the same experience, but in less time with less thought and strategizing, cool. Love Letter. I also was reminded a little bit of Clank, in the fact that it is sort of an area control game. It's a game that has one mechanic that feeds into another mechanic on a board. So in this game, you do trick-taking actions in order to move and score points on a board. In Clank, you do deck building in order to move and score points on a board. And deck building kind of has some of the same decisions where you have to figure out what your opponents are planning to do, mostly just to figure out what cards your opponents are planning to buy from a trade row and to a lesser extent where they plan on going on the board. So it's you're making similar decisions there, but just in kind of a slightly different genre of game.
Right.
All right. So that is our episode on Love Letter. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
So end of episode spiel. As always, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast, and you can go to our website, bgbcast.com, to find all of our episodes categorized with tags. For all the board games that we talk about in them, you will find this one with the Broom Seven Service Wonders. Tag.
Seven Wonders.
Well, we didn't. Well, so
I mentioned it.
Well, we mentioned it. I will only tag the episodes with what games we actually give sort of like a review on.
Okay,
so
sure.
Usually if we mention a game like we do at the end of these episodes, I won't tag it. But in the Good Stuffs episodes, I will tag all the games that we mention. That's the method of my madness, I suppose.
Right. You can also give us feedback on our social media accounts, or you can also rate us and comment us on your favorite podcasting app.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we are happy to hear all of your input and comments on the podcast.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, if you're interested in other podcasts and other websites, you can check out entertainthegeeky.com, where our friends Chris, Roger, and Jason host their own podcasts about nerd culture, nerd news, and nerd etc.
Mm-hmm. You can also go to their gear store, entertainthegeeky.com/gear, and that is where we sell our very own Board Game Bros t-shirts, and that's where they also sell their t-shirts and gear. Now, we have an update on our Kickstarter. As you know, Kickstarters are these kinds of things where you announce them and you get hyped for them, and then something happens and it has to be pushed back. And that's not happening this week, right, Matthew? Tell me it's not happening.
I'm sorry. We have to delay Conniving Cooks again. I apologize, but we are making sure that this Kickstarter does not become a Kickstarter disaster, because that's the other way Kickstarters tend to go.
Of course. Yeah, so we'd rather push it back than do it early and mess
up. Make mistakes.
We want you guys to get this game, and we'd rather you get it than say you get it and then fail to deliver on that. So
literally fail to deliver.
So October 1st is no longer the date. The date is now pending, I suppose.
Yes.
But we, as soon as we know something, we will let you know. And trust us when we say that nobody is more upset than we are, and nobody is more excited than we are to deliver this game to you. So keep an ear out, and we will let you know when you can obtain Conniving Cooks.
But there are two good announcements I want to go ahead and end this off with.
Okay.
The first is that, well, this is less of an announcement, more of a plug. That I have been streaming on Twitch, twitch.tv/twack, T-W-A-K. I have been streaming the video game The Messenger recently, but I'll be doing other stuff as well. That is weekdays from 10 a.m. Central. No, sorry, 11 a.m. Central to 1 p.m. Central.
Okay.
And then the other one is that we have a themed month coming up in October.
Oh, yeah.
So I think just saying those words, you can already guess what it is.
Yes, and maybe if I speak like this, you can understand what the theme might be.
Or if I go like this.
I tell you, you don't have to be a master at broom service and have the deduction skills to know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to do a spooky month. All horror-themed games.
But not necessarily scary games.
Yeah, just games with a scary theme or a horror theme.
A Halloween-appropriate theme, really.
Yes. So be on the lookout for that in October. And otherwise, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.